IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Keval Ramani, and today I'm here with a special guest, Dr. Hina Pandey. Dr. Pandey is a recent recipient of her doctorate. She finished her doctorate from JNU, and her focus was on former US President George W. Bush's nuclear policies. And that's, well, it's not exactly what we're here to talk about, but we're here to talk about something that she's written about quite a bit also, which is the recent developments with regard to Iran and the Iranian nuclear program, and more specifically, more immediately, the killing of the Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was interestingly killed in what seems to be an assassination that was carried out in a city on the outskirts of Tehran while he was on the road. The most latest information that I have about that is that apparently the Iranians believe that he was killed by an AI-powered weapon, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But what I want to sort of do is have this conversation with Dr. Pandey, trying to sort of pick her brain about what is it about Iran's nuclear program? How has the JCPOA, which is that nuclear deal that was signed, had an impact? What has been the impact of Trump's policies on all of this? And given that she studied George W. Bush's nuclear policies and all of this then happened in Obama's term and then under Trump, I'm hoping that she can provide us with a wonderfully rounded view of how American policy is shaped around this, what's been the response in Iran, and what's happening in the region, and also eventually what's happening with India's relationship because of all these dynamics. So, Dr. Pandey, welcome to the show. You know, thank you so much for joining us. I know that you've got quite a bit of work to do with CAPS since you're an associate fellow over there working on nuclear policy. So, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Manoj. It's great to be here.
Okay, so let's begin firstly with what we talked about when I initially reached out to you for this conversation. Let's begin with what's happened recently, right? I mean, tell us a little bit about who Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was and what was the significance to Iran's nuclear program and why is this a big deal? Because it seems like a really interesting development that in the beginning of the year we had an assassination in Iran, and again towards the end of the year we have an assassination in Iran. So who was this man? Why was he important?
Okay, so now the question that you've asked is very straightforward, you know, but I am afraid that the answer to this is not going to be very straightforward. And to understand, you know, the significance of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and, you know, why was he assassinated, one has to start an understanding of Iran's nuclear program. And so I would like to, you know, bring your attention at the outset to what is to be understood as Iran's nuclear program. And the reason why I think spelling it out is very important here is because oftentimes when we talk about the Iranian nuclear program, there are certain extreme alarming narratives that often get attached to it. Now, so which is why I want to sort of clear the slate. So Iran is an NPT member. We know Iran is one of the countries, was one of the first countries, in fact, to have signed the NPT. It ratified in the NPT in the year 1970. And Iran represents a very as somewhat successful case. It represents a grand bargain under the NPT. And what is that grand bargain? Is that a non-nuclear weapon state, because Iran is a non-nuclear weapons member to the NPT, Iran has voluntarily submitted its right to forgo the acquisition of nuclear weapons under certain articles of the NPT, and in exchange of that, Iran is going to get the benefits of peaceful nuclear energy, which is spelled out in the Article 4 of the NPT as well. Now, what happened in the year 2000, certain issues were discovered concerning the Iran's nuclear program. It was found out that Iran was clandestinely enriching the nuclear technology, and IAEA was not informed about it. IAEA had discovered this very late. And then Iran Came to be identified as a crisis in the whole nuclear non-proliferation regime. So what happens then subsequently? We see many rounds of negotiations. And then you come to JCPOA in the year 2015. P5 plus one and Iran signed a nuclear deal. And in the essence, of course, JCPOA looks at ensuring that Iran's nuclear program exclusively remains for the peaceful purposes. Now we can come to the JCPOA later. Now, coming back to the question on Iran's nuclear program, and why is it that we are hearing so much about Iran's program suddenly, you know, in this year? It is primarily because, of course, in 2018, President Trump had withdrawn from the JCPOA, and post that, you know, 2019 and 2020, specifically this year, the IAEA had released two reports, and these are two separate reports that deal with Iran's nuclear program. There is one report that deals with the JCPOA compliance issue with Iran, and there is another report that talks about that deals with the safeguard issues in relation to Iran's NPT commitments. So these two reports, you know, had been released, and there were certain discrepancies that had certain unresolved questions apparently, which Iran was asked. And since then, I think the you know Iran's nuclear program has evidently talked about. You know, little more. Now, coming to, obviously, the assassination, you know, assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Now, obviously, it is very, very difficult to know the exact, you know, extent of his contribution in the Iranian nuclear program. There is some public information available. We know from the Iranian sources that he was one of the most prominent nuclear scientists. We know it because several primary documents and Iranian foreign ministers and senior officials have confirmed and identified him to be an eminent Iranian scientist. In fact, the very fact that Javad Zarif has actually called out in his tweet for a condemnation of such an assassination is, you know, the importance of the fact can be gauged from this, that, you know, he is a significant person. There are several other officials in Iran who have also called vehemently opposed his assassination. But it is a very interesting point that one of the officials had made in his tweets. Now, this is a very translated, loosely translated from Google tweet. And he said that, you know, all the martyrs who were assassinated by great people, they have suffered a lot, but they are not irreplaceable. So the greatness of the work of this martyr, and he refers to you know Fakhrizadeh here, in upbringing hundreds of researchers and scientists cannot be, is he's saying that these martyrs are important, they are significant, but they are not irreplaceable. So you can actually understand as to how Iranian officials themselves have come out and you know given out certain important threads about this assassination. Who was he? As per the public information which is available, he was a physics professor at a university, at Imam Hussein University. He also served as a brigadier general in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and he is largely viewed as the father of Iranian nuclear program. And of course, when I look at nuclear program, I mean a program which is under the JCPOA compliance, which is under the NPT commitment. Now, Fakhrizadeh was actually an important figure because it is believed that he was the head of a scientific project from 1989 to 2003, which was involved in weapons development. And the issue is currently remains unresolved. And the Israeli and the American intelligence, they believe that his involvement was significant. And very recently, we have seen that his name had appeared in one of the sanctions list as well. So in the 2007 document of the UNSC, UNSC Sanction Committee, his name is specifically mentioned under the persons which are involved in the nuclear and ballistic missile activities. So this, I think, confirms the fact that he was an important person, you know, in relation to Iranian nuclear program. Coming to the question on, you know, whether his assassination can stop or delay or do any damage to Iranian nuclear program, well, that remains to be seen. And when we want to answer this question, I think there is an implicit understanding that Iran's nuclear program is viewed in terms of its military aspect, but that is not clear. And to add to that, I would just like to say that, you know, assassinations and these kind of sabotaging does not really affect a nuclear resolve of a country. You know, it can slow a progress. It may and may not slow a progress of a particular program. But I'm not sure if it really, damages Iran's nuclear resolve, which is to, remain in compliance with the JCPOA. So I think I'll just leave it at that.
So this is interesting, right? Because this is not the first assassination that's taken place of a nuclear scientist in Iran, right? In like over the years, I remember sort of back in about a decade ago, 2010, 2011, 12, there were a bunch of cases that came out with Iranian nuclear scientists being assassinated, or at least allegedly being assassinated. And all of those were also sort of linked in some way from the Iranian perspective, they were linked to Israel, but obviously very scant evidence that one can present for these things. But what I want to sort of ask you is that you've really outlined for us what Iran's nuclear program has been about, what how the JCPOA sort of came into being and what the role of Fakhrizadeh was. But can you tell us a little bit about the JCPOA itself? It was a deal related to the nuclear weapons program or the nuclear program in Iran. But it was also a sort of strategic shift that was taking place in Washington, where it was sort of seeking rapprochement with Iran. The fact that you were having this conversation between these two sides. And under Trump, there has been a change, not just in terms of that rapprochement with Iran, but also with regard to the broader Middle East. And that's what we're seeing with, say, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel being formed. So there is sort of a shift in the region that is pivoted around this agreement and the Iranian nuclear program. With that said, I want to sort of, we keep reading that, the JCPOA, Iran was compliant with the JCPOA, and that meant that it pushed it further away from creating a weapon. But if you sort of walk out of this agreement, it allows Iran to sort of get closer to building a weapon if it wants to. I wanted to sort of just explain to us, how do these estimations happen? What is the process of this estimation, if there is any? And was the JCPOA essentially about delaying or denying Iran a weapon if it wanted one?
Thank you for that question. Again, a very interesting, straightforward question, but not a straightforward answer to the question. I look at the JCPOA as strictly a nuclear document that had a lot of promise to, in facilitating peace and stability in the region. But when I look at JCPOA, I primarily look at a document that ensured Iran's nuclear program is going to remain exclusively for a peaceful program. It was expected that, when the implementation will take place, when, effective implementation is going to take place and Iran will remain in compliance with the JCPOA. Of course, there are certain benefits that will get triggered, and there is going to be more, engagement among the countries in the region. But that has not happened really. And now coming back to the document that is JCPOA, it was an agreement. It was a landmark deal which was signed between the countries, China, France, Germany, Russia, UK, in US, and Islamic Republic of Iran. The deal came after 18 months of really, really, really tough negotiations. And the reason Iran deal was hailed as a non-proliferation winner in the US, and as well by the non-proliferation experts, is because for the first time after the year 2002, after a decade, almost a decade later, a promise of non-proliferation promise was achieved. And this was important because Iran had challenged NPT from the inside. Iran was the only country that had challenged NPT in a way that it has not become a fully fledged nuclear weapon state, but it had shown that it has latent capabilities to, become a nuclear weapons capable state if it wants to. So in that regard, I think what JCPOA really did was to really, it settled the Article 4 of the NPT, because it provided Iran its right to enrichment. At the same time, it resolved the proliferation problem within the NPT. What were the broad parameters of JCPOA? Now, of course, JCPOA was not one of the best deals. It has been largely, addressed by the proponents and the opponents as a compromise. And what it really did, it ensured that the program is going to remain exclusively for peaceful purposes, but it introduced a lot of containment measures on the program. The JCPOA introduced certain limitations on Iran's clandestine enrichment, which was discovered in the year 2000s. And it said for at least 15 years, Iran will not enrich uranium fuel to 3.6%. Certain facilities such as Fordo is going to refrain from complete enrichment. Spent fuel will be sent back. And in the next 15 years, there is going to be in the total amount of the nuclear stockpile is going to be not more than 300 kgs. If Iran makes more spent fuel, all of this is going to be sold in the international market under international prices. And one of the reactors will be completely redesigned. Now, this is the first time ever Iran has actually agreed to certain these conditions. So in this respect, it was a very, very powerful and very promising document. And, you know, to elaborate a little more, you know, JCPOA actually did provide the IAEA a very greater access to you know, Iran's nuclear program, which was not there in the previous years, and so which is why, you know, there was this promise that JCPOA had. You have asked a question on how do you think it was effective or not. You know, how now the only organization which is responsible for the monitoring of the JCPOA and which has access to the ground facts, which and its inspectors are present on the ground. There are inspections taking place almost around the year. Reports are being shared. Now, the only organization which has done this is IAEA. And coming fast forward to November 2020, IAEA has expressed certain concerns about Iran's nuclear program, like I had mentioned in March, and it has also raised these concerns in the month of November as well. But IAEA has not declared that Iran is complying with, you know, the JCPOA. It has expressed concerns that Iran has amassed a lot of enrichment material and its stockpile has gone considerably higher, which was, which is not under the permissible limit of the JCPOA. And it happened in 2019, July, and more production had been done in the year 2020. But yet, the IAEA maintains that Iran still continues to permit the agency to make use of certain online enrichment monitors and electronic seals. And it is still allowing the inspectors to at least come and verify and continuously monitor, its the aspects of his nuclear program. So, and furthermore, it has also, Iran even today continues to provisionally apply the additional protocol to its program, which calls for intrusive examination, intrusive verification measures as well. So to answer your question on, whether JCPOA has been proven effective, there is no black and white answer to it. You know, I think the agency itself has said Iran still continues to cooperate, and there are certain issues that have come up. And very recently in August also, they have released a joint statement. Both the agency and Iran had released a joint statement, and they said Iran is going to continue cooperating further. Now, this happened obviously before the assassination of the nuclear scientist. So, of course, now then, you know, it gets more complicated. But as per the official data, as per, the qualified personnel who have verified the program, as on, let's say, November 20th, 2020, IAEA has not declared it is breaching, Iran is not complying at all with the JCPOA. So in that sense, you can see some efficacy. What Iran is doing currently is it's trying to, maneuver, and it's trying to drive a bargain, and by manipulating these provisions in IAEA, in the JCPOA, and Iran is further testing the waters. And I think it is doing that only because it would expect sanction relief, which it has been wanting for some time now.
Yeah, and that sanction relief has not come through, of course. And there's been lots, even more pressure that's come from the Trump administration, particularly when it pulled out of the deal. And of course, I presume that given the Trump administration's policies within the West Asia region, Iran's threat perception would have probably shot up compared to what it probably was under the Obama administration, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's look at what this sort of recent killing. I mean, there are a couple of actors here, right? There is Israel, of course, which is an actor which is critical in all of this. And then there is, of course, the fact that Trump is leaving the scene. come January 20th, and you have a Biden administration. And I was reading through the piece that you've written recently on after this assassination, where you talked about, you know, in that piece you quote Biden as having said in September 2020 that there's a smarter way to be tough on Iran. And a lot of the commentary after this assassination has been about how the real target of this assassination is not necessarily the nuclear program, but it's actually diplomacy that could happen in the future. Does it really sort of impinge on diplomacy in the future, particularly given that, you know, it's clear that the Biden administration would like to look at some sort of engagement with Iran rather than isolation of Iran? And how challenging would that be, given that, you know, the Middle East or West Asia is quite different from what it was 4 years ago, right? The fact that some of those conversations that used to happen behind the scenes between the Arab states and Israel are now much more public, you know, and there's a clearer relationship that's coming out, but at the center of which obviously is Iran. So I wanted to get a sense from you of how do you see sort of the prospects of a Biden engagement with Iran?
Yeah, so coming to the prospects of Biden administration, yeah, you know, he has a commitment to follow. There is a P4 plus one side to it also that is clearly watching, because they would expect Biden to deliver on its commitment. At the same time, how this has unfolded in the last couple of days, and in a piece, in my piece, I have mentioned this, you know, it might just happen that Iran will set some preconditions, you know, it might, try to pinch America on the JCPOA if it has to respond to this assassination. And I had said that, you know, Iran may ask for, may set sanction removal as a precondition, which it had done on 3rd of December. Because let's not forget that Iran has also carefully watched how North Korea and America has engaged with each other. So the only way to talk to Americans is, through the power of nuclear weapons. You know, you have a weapon and then you have the next step is, you know, diplomatic procedures will follow. So I am sure Iran has taken note of that. And this is exactly how, they have reacted. Iranian parliament, on the other hand, has also passed a bill, you know, that talks about, stopping its cooperation with the IAEA, which has been going on very smoothly or not so smoothly for some time. But it is something very interesting because the bill, as per the media reports, the Iranian parliament has maintained that Iran has to, expand its activities in the peaceful realm. It has not specifically said, it has not said any, talked about any military aspect to the nuclear activities. And while it may look like, Iran is clearly trying to up the red lines, it's also important to understand that it is just on paper right now. You know, it has not taken the action. And the monitoring agency has not confirmed. You know, let's also understand the inspectors are, and the inspectors may be on the ground, and there are certain verification measures that are still taking place. Continuous 24/7 monitoring of Iranian nuclear program is taking place. So I think with Iran is just trying to, leverage its position vis-a-vis JCPOA, and it is trying to just, push and test the waters, and it is demanding sanction relief as a bargain. This is how they are. That's their bargain tactic. So
yeah, and it's really interesting, right? Because in some ways, it does sort of strengthen Iran. This assassination strengthens Iran's hand in negotiation with an American administration that might be more predisposed to negotiation,
right?
Not necessarily, like Trump. And I mean, I was just going through some polling data from American perspective on Iran. And what I found was that, earlier this year, Pew had a survey which talked about how only 6% of Americans, the lowest in history in some ways, view Iran as a national security threat, which tells you that there is room for negotiation. It talks about how another poll that I was noticing was, there was a Reuters Ipsos poll again in January this year, which talked about how 53% of American adults disapproved of Trump's handling of Iran. And this came after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. So it's interesting that Biden does have leeway. It depends. One needs to look at polling data of how, U.S. congressional representatives view Iran. I don't think they'd view it favorably, or they'd view negotiation necessarily favorably, but there is reasonable, in the public consciousness, it doesn't seem like Iran is as much of a threat like say what it was maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, yet it remains heightened. I presume that sort of public consciousness shifted to Russia and China and sort of great power rivalry in that sense. So it'll be interesting to see whether Biden has room and how this sort of assassination constrains or creates new strengths for maybe Iran in terms of the negotiation.
If I may add to the point yes. you just raised, I'm not sure whether the public consciousness has really shifted towards negating the Iranian threat. I think the American public nuclear anxiety raises every time something on Iran and North Korea is being talked about. So I'm not too sure about this. But I was just thinking as you were you had raised a point on how smartly Iran can actually negotiate the JCPOA to its favor, especially when it has actually seen the promise of a negotiation from the incoming Biden administration. And that makes me want to ask a question as to why Iran is focusing on JCPOA. Why not elsewhere? Why will it not take action at another platform? Why will it not react any other manner? It's because it is, at the end of it, let's understand that the larger goal of Iran in all these years has been sanction relief. And JCPOA is the platform that can provide it sanction relief. It is the only platform that can provide it Iran sanction relief. And the larger goal of America is also non-proliferation. So I do see some promise. Of course, on the face of it, it doesn't look like it's going to get, the two parties are getting into any agreement, because both of them are currently setting certain preconditions. Iran has set its precondition. Biden has also stated unless and until it is complying. So it's a circle, right? But I think it is still too early to comment. I mean, there is still time, 40 more days to go. And it will be fruitful if both parties can maintain restraint and patience. And that is what I think is that's how I look at the evolving.
That's fascinating. I think, I presume that a much more reasoned approach by both parties would be beneficial from an Indian perspective also. And that's the last bit that I want to turn to is, one scene, right? India's, particularly Trump, our choices of engagement in the region have increasingly shifted. And our engagement with Iran has also shifted ever since the U.S. walked out of the JCPOA. How does this new dynamic, does it create new opportunities for us or does it sort of constrain us? Because as far as I know, and I could be wrong here, but as far as I know, I don't think the Indian MEA issued a statement after the assassination of Akhzada, right?
I don't think so. I haven't seen it. Not till today morning.
So how does it sort of constrain or how does it sort of... Does it create new opportunities if there is chance for diplomacy, hopefully under Biden, or do the sort of changes in the region, which I've sort of talked about, right? The shift in Israeli relationships with the Gulf states, the emergence of Iran under Trump as sort of the threat number one in the region, and this sort of maximum pressure campaign against Iran also. Does that sort of constrain India's choices, or will India now sort of breathe easy in this sense with Biden taking charge?
So actually, the thing is, it's really, really too early to comment right now, and the reason why I'm saying is because, let's wait for 16 December. There is going to be a joint commission meeting. The joint committee of the JCPOA is going to meet in Vienna on December 16th. And they will discuss further implementation and how to effectively, talk about salvaging the JCPOA. And my sense is that today is 7th, I think till 16th, I'm assuming there will be some patience, some restraint will be seen. And even on the 16th, there are certain ways in which scenarios can unfold. First of all, now this is from the text of the JCPOA, this is how the Joint Commission and the dispute settlement mechanism is supposed to work. If the parties meet on December 16th, they will come to a positive solution. I'm assuming. So if they come to a positive solution, then I'm assuming everything will be well. It will create opportunities for I think all the parties to engage with Iran. But I think the issue is slightly tricky, and if you look at what are the provisions in the JCPOA, in the text of the JCPOA, I think the parties will look at, an extension of 15 days as well, which is something that the JCPOA grants them. So after that 15 days, then, you see, it's all easily they have stretched the matter till 31st December. And then again, there's also a provision to extend the matter for another 15 days, and then the advisory board can come in and it can, give out a non-binding opinion on compliance within 15 days. So it is really important for these developments to, see the reality and, come into play before we really make these judgments as to how, scenario is going to evolve. The idea in asking the question that how it is going to impact, regional players or, bilateral equations of the countries, we are somewhat convinced that it may not deliver. It may get escalated into something that is non-constructive. So I think it is still, there is still time to be seen. And even when the dispute settlement mechanism is doing its task, finally, what is going to really unfold will only be visible not before the first month of the next year, which is January. Because ultimately, I think it's only close to Biden's assuming presidency, we will be able to tell as to how these developments are going to unfold. Till that time, I think Iran is likely to restrain, and and it has shown significant restraint till now. It has certain narratives it has to project, and there is a domestic audience that it also has to satisfy. But Iran has not gone overboard. It has not really escalated the issue out of hand, because it still wants to deal, maturely when the December 16 meeting is taking place. And because that is soon going to determine the actions of other players, and specifically US, because depending on how this meeting is going to unfold, I think Biden administration will also respond to what kind of conditions or how it wants to engage Iran on the issue.
All right, that's fascinating. So I guess we have to look forward to what happens on December 16th and then keep a close eye till January 20th, which is when Biden takes charge, and the developments that happen between then. Thank you so much, Dr. Pandey. This has been a wonderfully insightful episode. Lots of things that I've learned from this conversation, and I'm sure that our listeners, not viewers, would be enriched by this conversation. Thank you so much, and I hope that once things develop and we have a clearer picture, we can again sort of have a conversation about what this sort of nuclear deal with Iran is going to be like, or is like, once Biden takes charge.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Please consider signing up for Takshashila's courses. Applications are now open, and you can apply at www.takshashila.org.in/courses.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends, and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.